We're continuing our learning of Parshat Vayishev. What we did last time was we broke the Parsha down into its four parts.
Okay.
Do you remember from last week what our four parts were? Parshat Vayishev. We had
Yosef
and the brothers. We had Yehuda and Tamar. I hope it's in your notes because it's on the board, it's not like English. Good. Three. Next is? We had Yosef in Beit Potiphar. And then we had Yosef in jail. What we said last time was there is a beautiful narrative in here if you skip from 1 to 3 to 4, which is Yosef has struggles with his brothers. We saw the emergence of that hatred and that jealousy of that sinah and that kinah come up amongst the brothers, which then leads Yosef to be sold down to Mitzrayim. Yosef is in Beit Potiphar. Yosef overcomes the seduction of Eshet Potiphar, but that puts him at odds with Potiphar himself, and ends up in the Beit Asor, ends up in jail, and Parsha. One clear narrative, one story that takes us from beginning to middle to end. Doesn't really take us to the end of the story, but it takes us to the end of the Parsha. And we ask, what is this Yehuda and Tamar story doing here? First of all, what is the story of Yehuda and Tamar? What is that story doing in the Chumash at all? How did that story happen? But on top of that, even if it did happen, and it has to go somewhere, why put it in the middle of a beautiful, simple, clear, structured parsha? You could have put that anywhere between Yosef and the brothers and when Yehuda goes and talks to his father about going down to Mitzrayim when the 7 years of famine hit. There was a lot of opportunity to put it somewhere else. Why here? And we said, as always is the case, that's bringing out deeper elements of the parsha. That what's happening as soon as there is this conflict between Yosef and the brothers, as soon as we meet them, we get to know them, and we start to set them on their journeys, and we're framing it, I'm framing it a little bit differently this time. I want to frame it a little bit more clearly this time. Immediately following that, we see the beginnings of the two lines of Malchut being planted. How do we know that Yosef is going to be a Melech? He told us in the first part, he talked about how everybody was going to bow down to him. First the brothers, then the second dream where the sun, the moon, and the stars were all going to go back and we're going to bow down to him. And so immediately, what has to happen in order for Yosef's dreams of Malchut to come true? Where does he have to go? Mitzrayim. So these are the earliest seeds that will sprout into the Malchut of Yosef. That's what's happening in part 3 and part 4. This is the road to Malchut. And in part 2, what do we have at the end of the story of Yehuda and Tamar? Last 2-3 Pesukim. Say it more clearly in terms of the Pesukim. The birth of Peretz, meaning the relationship between Yehuda and Tamar gives birth to twins. One of whom is Peretz, which is literally the seeds of his Malchut, which will emerge through Peretz, eventually Boaz, then eventually in David. David, which is the extension of Yehuda. So we actually are jumping right into the two parallel lines of kingship that are going to be working throughout all of history, but certainly working throughout these parshiyot. That's what we're setting the stage for these two lines of kingship. And in examining the context of the meaning of these two stories, we saw that there was a deep contrast between the nature of the Malchut of Yosef that's being set up in this Parsha and the Malchut that's going to come from Yehuda through David in this Parsha. What did we say that we saw by Yosef? What happens to Yosef in part 3? He says no to Eshet Potiphar. He denies Eshet Potiphar. He becomes, through that interaction, that turning point in his life, he becomes Yosef HaTzadik. And the line of Mashiach ben Yosef is going to be encompassing one of the major elements of this piece is going to be that that's the line of the Tzadik. As opposed to Yehuda, what happens to Yehuda in this story? As opposed to Yosef, he gives in to seduction. And he has a relationship with Tamar. But at the same time, when Tamar is, as we talked about last time, on the stake, ready to be burned, she shows clear signs that the child is actually whose? Yehuda. And what does he immediately say? Tzadkan yimeni. He immediately does tshuva. And he becomes a paradigm for the line of malchut of the Baal Tshuva. As we talked about last time, the Gemara is now under sheets that I quoted last time outside. You can see it now, and if you want inside of verse 9, I'm even going to quote it inside. But the Gemara in the second of Avodah Zarah talks about how he who comes from Yehuda, David, we're going to be talking about a lot, Yehuda and David, when used interchangeably, they're that line of Malchut, that the only reason why the Maasev Batsheva came across David's path was so that he would sin and be able to teach tshuva, the ways of tshuva of the individual to all of Klal Yisrael. He's the paradigm Baal tshuva. The same way, in such a concise and powerful way, Yehuda says, Tzadkan yimeni. David HaMelech, when he comes to the Maaseh with Bathsheba, in the same powerful nature, says, let's go back to the verse. Do you mind if I borrow that? Okay. In Sefer Shmuel Bet, I like bringing this up also because to see it inside is very powerful. It says over here, "Vayomer David al Natan." Immediately says, "Chatati laHashem." Also, two words, very powerful. Zatkan meni chatati laHashem. I once heard, I forget from whom. I feel bad that I can't quote where I heard it from. Beautiful, beautiful pshat, or understanding of what's happening here. You see, that's very unusual. It happens very infrequently in Tanakh. There's actually a break in the middle of that pasuk. Usually when you have the parshiot, p'tuchot, and sumot, they're at the end of a pasuk. It's very rare. It happens one from time and again. But it's very rare to have a break in the middle of a pasuk. And I once heard that one pshat on what's happening there is that in that white space where nothing is written, meaning there's infinite potential there, that although in the context of the narrative of Shmuel Bet, the story goes on. What happens in that white space? All of Sefer Tehillim. That's where all of Sefer Tehillim pours out. In that white space after Chatati Moshe. And that's why there's a pause after there's a break. And that's the birth of all of Tehillim, is this desperation on David's part to get back to be close to a Kadosh Baruch Hu as the paradigm of Shmuel Bet as well. Right? So we have these two parallel lines, the Tzadik and the Baal Tshuva. Begs the question, which one is ideal? Which one is preferable? What is the ideal, the Tzadik or the Baal Tshuva? What do you think?
I know what Baal Tshuva is ideal, I don't understand.
You say, it's clear where we're headed that it's going to be the Baal Tshuva. But I don't know why. So you're saying the Tzadik.
Different Chazal, people throw out around Rosh Hashanah time. It never really goes well with the Baal Tshuva. It's never did it for me.
Well, in around a half an hour from now, we'll find out if we're in that bucket or in the other bucket. Good, okay. Hopefully it'll be a meaningful share. Yeah, go for it.
I think that Tzadik is ideal, but I think that having Baal Tshuva there and having such great success stories from being Baal Tshuva is kind of gives you hope for when you do mess up.
So, Bracha, you're saying, I feel like it's the Baal Tshuva, but it seems like more likely that it's
Tzadik. I know the answer you're going to give is Baal Tshuva, and I lot of people get this out, but it seems kind of like fluffy to me.
And Shandy is saying that Tzaddik is the more obvious one also. It's definitely more obvious that it's the Tzaddik. The Tzaddik is the one who doesn't sin. Yosef is the one who doesn't give in to seduction. Yosef is the one who stands up. Yosef is the one who does, unlike Aaron Onan, or even far, much farther off than Yehuda. We talked about how Aaron is Ra Be'enei Hashem. Onan is Ra Be'enei Hashem.
It wasn't like Yosef wasn't tempted. If he would say, like, oh, by nature, he got very close to...
And he overcomes.
Right, so I would think that would be better than actually, like...
Committing the sin itself.
It wasn't like he knew the line to tempt him. His tool was on the line.
Yeah.
And then he stepped back. That, for me, sounds greater than sort of crosses the line that steps back.
100%. And that's definitely the more obvious of the two answers.
I do think that like the Tzaddik is definitely the more obviously correct, whatever. But I think that Balshul also has a lot more potential. Like the Tzaddik does what he does, and he might overcome a lot of things, and like that's really great. But Balshul has a lot of potential from where he came from that like can propel him.
Excellent. So let's build to where you're at. Yeah, that's it.
Both my parents are insanely flaming about Yeshua, insane. And I know from personal experience that they have to work so hard to get where they are, like with their family and not accepting them and everything. So I feel like for people who are just kind of born into it or it's their nature, they never understood what it's like to fight for it.
100%. Actually, that's beautiful because that comes back to Bracha's point.
No, that's because Yosef did fight for it.
Right, meaning that somebody who's born an FFB and is like born the son of a Rosh Yeshiva and grows up in the Yeshiva and then enrolls in the Yeshiva and then davens and learns in the Yeshiva and then becomes a Rebbe in the Yeshiva and then has kids in the Yeshiva and then has a testament in the Yeshiva, right? And literally never got out of the Yeshiva. If that person didn't go through any internal process, that's not a tzaddik. I always get afraid to say it on recording, but I mean, it's of all places, one of the places that screams the loudest is in Tivot Shalom, and that's the Sefer of Chassidut, where you think that he would say the opposite. He says that a person who literally just rides out life in a way where there's no effort put in whatsoever, he says that person, even if black and white, Tivot Shalom, I mean, it's the other Sfarim also, but black and white there, he says that if a person comes to Kadosh Baruch Hu and says, I spent my whole life davening, I spent my whole life learning, I'm ready for Gan Eden, Kadosh Baruch Hu is going to go, why? You totally wasted your time.
But Yosef never fell, so he would never know
But as Bracha pointed out, Yosef felt that pull. Yosef was tempted.
He never fell.
But he overcame. Meaning life is about making intentional choices and deciding who you are, what you believe. A person, I mean, we're jumping around a little bit, we'll come back to Bill in a second, but a person can live the life of a tzaddik. They're only a tzaddik if they fight tooth and nail for their tzidkut. That has to be part of it. Adam la'amal yulad, you're put here to work. Look at Yosef's emunah. What was expected of Yosef? Yosef is sitting in jail. And while he's sitting in jail, what happens? He is able to interpret two people's dreams, and one of them is going to die, and one of them is going to go back and literally have the ear of the king. And Yosef says, just remember me. By Yosef, that was a sin. Yosef was the tzaddik. Yosef, whose emunah is supposed to be in a complete and perfect place, for Yosef to say, remember me, is to deny God's hashkacha. And that cost him 2 years. To think that there's no internal process, certainly by the FFB of today's day and age, where there's a lot missing from the majority of today's day and age FFBs, of process and struggle and toil to figure out what is the nature of my emunat Hashem? Why do I believe in God? Why is the Torah true? Why am I davening every single day? Why am I learning Torah all day? What's the compelling reason? Why am I living this way? That process is required. It doesn't require chet and tshuva. Yosef proves that. Yosef becomes Yosef HaTzadik despite not having succumbed to the seduction of Eshet Potiphar, but because of his interaction with Eshet Potiphar. It's both. So again, on the surface, especially if we're claiming that you have to go through that struggle, the struggle which you watch, meaning that's very real, that has to be real. That if your struggle is there, again, it would seem that the tzaddik would be the obvious choice. And yet, we daven all the time for Mashiach. And what Mashiach do we daven for? Mashiach ben David. He's clearly the end point. Many people don't even know there is such a concept of Mashiach ben Yosef. Mashiach ben David is part and parcel of it's part of how we talk, it's part of how we think, it's part of how we daven. We're fully aware of the concept of Mashiach ben David. Clearly that's the end goal. And we use Pesukim to back it up. There was one time when we were given, as a nation, a clear vision of exactly what the end goal of history would be, a vision of the end of days. Where do we have a vision of the end of days as a people? Only happened once. Always happens at the beginning. Sof Masad Machshavat Tchila. Where do we have that vision? Even earlier. I'm going to leave Queens, and we're still not going to get back to... Yes, thank you. What specifically a Kriyat Yam Suf?
What
specifically a Kriyat Yam Suf?
Wasn't like even a maidservant had...
Yes, but what was it? What was the content of the vision of Kriyat Yam Suf? What? Az Yashir! Az Yashir is that nivuah. Is the national nevuah, but we're seeing what's going to be all the way throughout history. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and what you're pointing out, that even the Shivcha on the Yam, meaning even the lowliest person that has seen it, I believe it's what Chaim Shmuel Levitin points out, I don't know if it's in the name of somebody else or not, but he points out that it's very telling that who saw it, what did you say, what was the word? The Shivcha. What should she have been called? What was she having at that moment? She should have been a Nidiyah. Why should we call her Shivcha, which is the lowliest way to describe her? At that moment, she was a prophetess. And he says, no, that was the problem. Despite, not just her, despite all of their visions, despite that national vision, nobody became a Navi through that process. It wasn't earned yet. We're at the beginning of the process. The Kadosh Baruch Hu gave us that Nevuah as a people, as a gift, so we would know the goal to be able to work towards that goal for all of history. And the very end of that Shira, the very end of that Nivuah, is source number 3. Tevi'im v'titzeim v'har nachalatcha, machon shivtecha pa'alta Hashem, mikdash Hashem korenu yadecha. What's the goal of history? What's the end of that pasuk? Mikdash Hashem korenu yadecha? Mikdash Hashem korenu yadecha. What's the goal? Beit HaMikdash. The Mikdash of Hashem will you build with your hands. Hashem Yimoch Yilamber. Then eventually the Malchut of HaKadosh Baruch will be revealed in the world. So the goal is to get to Beit HaMikdash. Who builds Beit HaMikdash? Yes. Who builds the first Beit HaMikdash? Who? Shlomo HaMelech. The son of? David HaMelech. David gets us to Mikdash Hashem Kedin Decha for the first time. He's going to get us to Mashiach Ben David also. And he's going to build the third Mikdash also. Bezrat Hashem Mihir Abi Aminu. Bezrat Hashem Mihir Abi Aminu. We're going to get there. But the first Beit Mikdash is built by Shlomo, the son of David. Wait, no. Not just the son of David. The son of David and? David and Batsheva. Only hammering home the point that somehow the goal of history, which is Beit HaMikdash, is not just coming through he who is the paradigm Baal Tshuva, as we're told in the Gemara of Avodah Zarah that we saw before. But it's even coming through that relationship itself. The relationship between David and Bathsheba produces a child, and that child dies. And then David and Bathsheba have another child, and that child is Shlomo HaMelech who builds Beit HaMikdash. The process of Tshuva gets us to Beit HaMikdash. If Beit HaMikdash comes into existence as a result of the tshuva process, then as long as we look at the tshuva process as being something that's bidyeved, as being something that's not ideal, then it means that there's something about our notion of tshuva itself that's off. Yeah.
But what we know that Mashiach and Yosef will come before Mashiach and David. So what if, yeah, it still is the ideal, but it didn't work. We're all Bali Tshuva, so we came. The ideal, the little feel of we came. It didn't work for us because we're a nation of Bali Tshuva at this point. And then we have to go to the Bidyeved, we have to go to Mashiach and David.
So it's not Bidyeved. The goal is the maybe I misunderstood your point, but the goal is the Mikdash that's going to be built by originally Shlomo, eventually Mashiach ben David.
But Mashiach ben Yosef, like what? Because Mashiach ben Yosef comes first, maybe that's lechatchila.
And then no, it's paving the way for Mashiach ben David. The way that Mashiach ben Yosef is understood is that Mashiach ben Yosef begins the process and paves the way for the ultimate Mashiach to stand up. Mashiach always has to come from Yehuda. Malchut has to come from Yehuda. That's the way Malchut in Klal Yisrael works. Not from Yosef. So the Malchut that exists by Yosef is real and it's important and we need to understand what it is. Yosef goes down to Mitzrayim first and paves the way for Klal Yisrael to come down. But the ultimate Mashiach is going to be Mashiach ben David. That is the goal that we're striving for.
I could be completely making this up, but isn't there like a thing that Mashiach ben Yosef might not come? Like there are certain things that he would like if it happens like at the end of the time, like, then he would come. But if it happens early, then he wouldn't come.
I heard that it came already.
Sarah Kuhn.
Okay.
But the paradigm is, it could be that the paradigm could be broken under certain circumstances, maybe that I'm not familiar with, it's totally possible. But even if it's broken, what inevitably still remains?
Yeah.
Right, meaning like that's the part that's immovable and that still supports our point. There's always Mashiach ben David, which again implies that it's possible that as long as we see tshuva as being only a bidyeved reality, as only being a reality of something which is, okay, after the fact, what are you going to do? You have to do tshuva. We have to understand more deeply what is tshuva about, what is tshuva. We see another Gemara that supports this incredibly. The Gemara in source number 4 says, Vatanya, Shiva Dvarim Nivru Kodem Shinivra Olam. There are 7 things that were created even before the world itself was created. And one of those things is tshuva. That's an incredibly powerful point. If we were to look at tshuva simply being as a bidyeved response to when mistakes are made, so then HaKadosh Baruch Hu should have created the world first. And then, when people sinned, so he created tshuva because lo aleinu people sinned. But the implication that tshuva was created even before the world is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created something called tshuva, which was a necessity. And then after that, he created the forum in which that tshuva would play out. It's a totally different way of seeing tshuva. And reality, for that matter. If tshuva were simply meant as like, okay, if we make a mistake, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu had to make a way for us to get out of it. So create the world first, and then when mistakes are made, HaKadosh Baruch Hu creates tshuva, and tshuva is a way to get out of that rut. But by creating tshuva before even creating the world, HaKadosh Baruch Hu was saying that somehow the goal is tshuva. The goal of the world is tshuva. I'm creating tshuva now, I'm creating the forum in which that's going to play out, I'm creating reality. But it precedes it, because it's foundational for it. That which precedes the world means that which the world is meant to come and produce. The world becomes a means and a process to lead to tshuva. The fact that it's created first means, how do I bring it about? The world needs to bring about tshuva. The world is going to be designed to bring about the ultimate goal of tshuva. And again, on this level, this completely supports what we were talking about before. That tshuva is much more lechatchila than we often relate to it. It's much more of an ideal that we're trying to attain. So let's try to understand why, and we'll build toward, I think, that which Davida said much earlier. a lot of very interesting and very challenging gevarot about tshuva. One of them is the following, and this one also gets quoted all the time around Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, and hopefully now we'll put it in. Hopefully we'll do better and put it in a meaningful light for you. Source number 5 from Masechet Yoma: Amar Reish Lakish, Gdola Tshuva Shezdonot Naasot Lo Kishkagot. Tshuva is so great because it is able to turn your intentional sins into accidental sins. Meaning, I go and I actively do a chet, lo aleinu. I go and I actively do a chet. Then I do tshuva. That tshuva can make my sin have the status of an intentional sin, to being switched to having the status of an accidental sin, a lesser punishment, leniency. Continues the Gemara. Ein iva amar Reish Lakish, but didn't Reish Lakish say, Gdola tshuva shezdonot naasot lo kizchuyot? We have another saying of Reish Lakish, and there he said what? No, when I do tshuva, the sins that I did that were intentional don't just become the status of accidental sins. They actually manage to go and become zchuyot. They become merits. How do we understand this discrepancy in Reish Lakish? Says the Gemara. Lo kasha, it's not a question. Kan me'ahava, kan me'ira. If you do tshuva me'ira, then your intentional sins get leniency and they become like accidental sins. If you do tshuva me'ahava, then your intentional sins can even become for you like zchuyot. I think it's important to draw out this Gemara. This Gemara is insane. This Gemara is wild. Just imagine the scenario. I like to go through this when I teach this Gemara, just to really play out the scenario for a second. Okay? You guys are all in Midrasha. You guys are all in Category 2. You guys are all Tikkaniyot. Right? So you get to Shemayim, and you go and you take your huge sack of mitzvot, and you place it down in front of a Kadosh Baruch Hu. You say, listen, I did the best I could, I did a wonderful job in this world, I have this whole bag of mitzvahs, I'm ready to rock, here's my down payment for Olam Haba. And you're starting to negotiate the plot of land at Olam Haba when you hear this incredibly irritating creaking sound coming from behind you. And it's getting louder and louder and louder. Like, I waited literally my whole life. I'm dead now. I waited my whole life to have this conversation with a Kadosh Baruch Hu. And there's this annoying sound in the background. They don't have noise-canceling walls in Olam Haba. What's going on? And you turn around, and who do you see? That girl. You know what I'm talking about. You see that one. The most annoying, frustrating person you know. Person who you know your whole life, you're watching them just do avera after avera after avera, and they didn't care. And you turn around, and that creaking noise is, she's got this huge cart full of mitzvot. And she goes, excuse me, would you mind stepping aside for a second? And she goes and drops her huge cart in front of a Kadosh Baruch Hu and says, I'd like to make my down payment for the Olam. At which point you go, she spent her whole life sinning. So great! She was able to do tshuva at the end of her life. She goes and takes all of the horrible things in her life and they become zchuyot. She comes with even more mitzvot than you have. That doesn't make any sense. When you walk away from those shirim, you get up to that person who gave the shir and you say, that doesn't make any sense. You can't just say, well, look, tshuva me'ahava, let's all have a party and go to Yom Kippur. That's not a thing. I don't understand what that means. Chazal is saying this, that means this is part of the spiritual mechanics of reality. How does that work? So the mashal that I like to give is as follows. And again, this does reach back to your point. When I imagine the concept of the two different types of tshuva, tshuva mi'ira and tshuva mi'ahava, the mashal that comes to my mind is like falling into a hole. Which isn't much of a mashal because sinning is like falling into a hole. Right? You trip and you fall and you get hurt. That's what happens. Now you're in that hole. You have three choices. One of them isn't even on the list. You could sit down, be depressed, lie down, and never come out of the hole. Lo aleinu. B'ezrat Hashem, that should never happen to anyone. Though it is more prevalent nowadays than it's possibly ever been in the past. Let's talk about options 2 and 3. Option number 2 is you got to get out. And so you take your fingers, right? And you dig them into the walls of that hole. And you, inch after inch after inch, you claw yourself out of that hole. And you end up right back on the ground. You might be dirty. Your clothes might be soiled by the dirt. You might have dirt all over your face. But you got back to the ground. That's one option. Option number two is you realize the opportunity that's before you. You realize, oh wow, that the ground is far away. I got to get back there. I didn't know what it was like to be so far down in the ground. This is very scary and I don't want to be here. I want to be there. And you push down against the ground with your legs and you create a tremendous amount of potential energy. And you spring up and you jump so high because you're so desperate to get back to the ground that you jump even higher than the ground itself and then you're able to land softly. And you're right back where you were. But you're not soiled, you're not dirty, your face is clean, your clothing is fine. You achieved something you didn't know you could do. That to me is the difference between tshuva meyira and tshuva me'ahava. Tshuva meyira is recognizing that you did something wrong and being so scared, just like you were so scared of being stuck in that hole, being so scared of that fate, that you're willing to claw your way back to HaKadosh Baruch Hu so you don't experience punishment from that sin. And so HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, fine, you get that you did something wrong, you get that you have to do tshuva, you understand the mechanics of reality, and I want to do tshuva. And so HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, fine. You go from shkagot, shkagot. The severity of your punishment is lessened because you understand what the goal of reality is, that you messed up. But there's a whole other way to approach tshuva. Which is when I sin, and again, this doesn't work if one sins intentionally. We're talking about always when a person, lo aleinu, does fall into sin. But if I do fall into sin, I get farther away from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. In that moment, I have a choice. I can simply try to claw my way back to where I was, but at the end, I'm still going to be dirty. I'm still going to be soiled by what happened. That's when you move and become a intentional sin becomes but you're still dirty. It's still a shogeg. It's still an accidental sin. You still have some remnant of it. You say, no! I didn't even understand what I had before. Before I was over here. Before I was close to a kind of sparkle, I didn't appreciate it. And now I've gone backwards. Now I feel that distance. And I don't care about this sin, and I don't care about the punishment. I'm not focused on it. I'm focused on one thing and one thing only. I love a Kaddish Baruch Hu, and I can't believe that I got far away from a Kaddish Baruch Hu. I only want to get closer. And I use that distance, I use that pull back, and I create potential energy, and I push myself so far forward that I'm even closer to a Kaddish Baruch Hu than I was before the chait. I don't overcome the avira. I don't overcome the chait. I transform the chait into an opportunity for closeness with the Kadosh Baruch Hu. That's the spiritual mechanics underneath this Gemara. It's not a simple thing at all. And it has to come from Ahava. What is Ahava? I'm longing for you. So I'm so desperately want to get close to you. Like the person so desperately wanted to get back to the ground. They weren't afraid of dying in the hole. They realized what it meant to have freedom. They just wanted to get back. That they jump even higher than the ground itself. I love HaKadosh Baruch Hu so much that I allowed the distance to teach me what it means to be far away. I learned from that. Use it as an opportunity to draw me even closer than it was before. That's the power of tshuva me'ahava. That's the power of tshuva that we're talking about. Where the distance from God becomes the longing for God that you didn't have before. And you take advantage of that to connect in all new ways. Where we allow our mistakes to teach us to become even greater than we were originally. Tshuva is an unbelievable concept. It's an unbelievable thing that exists. Tshuva transcends time. When we think about actions in the past, things that we've done in the past, can they change? No, they're stuck in the past. I have the present. I can build towards the future, but the past is what it is. Says Judaism, that's not true. Says Torah, that's not true. Everything in my past is all potential energy. And it depends on what I do from here on out. I can literally turn back the clock and transform that fate into zchuyot. I can transform that previous action that was negative into a positive that draws me closer to a HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's the power of what tshuva can accomplish. Past, present, and future are completely interacting with each other. They're alive, they're dynamic, and they're flexible. They're not fixed. We're not slaves to our past actions. They become a slave to us. If we utilize them, if we tap into them, if we turn them into opportunities to draw closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Taking all of this back to Malchut. Who is ultimately going to attain the final level of kingship, the ultimate kingship in Klal Yisrael? Yehuda and David. Mashiach ben David. It's going to come through David. It's going to come through the process of the Baal Tshuva, which means that the primary process of moving to the Malchut of the end of days is primarily a Baal Tshuva process. It's a totally different way of looking at the world. All of the sin, all of the chit, all of the destructiveness in the world that exists, it all is sitting there as potential to be tapped into, to spring us forward into a reality of tikkun. That is ultimately what will bring about a reality of Mashiach, will bring about a reality of Beit HaMikdash. My Rebbe quotes here a medrash that I haven't been able to find. I searched for it in the winter midrashah. I wasn't able to find it then. I still haven't been able to find it now. If anybody listening to this shiur in the room, if it ever gets beyond the room, if anybody hears this and you can, and you know where this midrash is, I need to see it inside, because a midrash that's this powerful, I think it's irresponsible to quote it without seeing the Lashon of Chazal. But I'm going to do it anyway. And I'll do tshuva later. Okay. But I'm going to do it anyway. Because it's such a, this is an incredible, and my Rebbe said it, it has to, I mean, he saw it inside. My Rebbe said this, where my Rebbe quoted it. Midrash says as follows. After Yehuda was just overtaken with this insanity and goes and finds a zona on in the middle of the road, he has a relationship with her, he's broken. This is Yehuda that we're talking about. Remember who we're talking about. This is one of the children of Yaakov. This is one of the Shiftei Kah. This is one of the people who's going to be, he's going to become, he may not know it yet or not, he's going to become the Sheva that's going to be the ultimate Malchus of Klal Yisrael. He's destroyed. And a Kadosh Baruch Hu comes upon Yehuda, says the Midrash evidently. HaKadosh Baruch Hu comes to Yehuda and says, hear the words, what are you so upset about? Don't you know that that's how kings are made? I'm like desperate for the Lashon of Chazal that says that. So if you can find it, let me know. Don't you know that that's how kings are made, Yehuda? You want to be king? You're going to make mistakes and you need to learn from them and you need to harness them and you need to utilize them to draw you closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Again, I want to reemphasize, never to sin intentionally. There is no such thing as an intentional sin that's good. The first person to ever make that mistake was, fun fact, shear for another time, but fun fact, Adam Arishon. Adam Arishon knew exactly what was going on in Gan Eden, and he chose, for whatever reason, to eat from the fruit. Clearly thinking that somehow eating from the fruit and doing something wrong and then doing tshuva for it and then bringing them back, that that was somehow going to be a more positive reality. He was wrong. You never, ever sin intentionally. You never choose to not be Yosef. But for those of us in the room who are the Yehudas in the room and the Davids in the room, the Baalei Tshuva in the room, once you sin, then that means you have the potential for, you have the potential to become a David, you have the potential to become a Yehuda, Chatati Hashem, Sitkami Meni. You have the potential to write Sefer Tehillim. You have the potential to produce a David HaMelech, to produce a Shlomo HaMelech, to build a Tamikdash. And that's exactly what we've seen all throughout Sefer Bereishit. These are the seeds in which David himself is planted. Where was the first seed of David planted? By whom? Think back. We had a whole shiur on it. Good 6 months ago.
Ruth?
Even before then. Where does Ruth come from?
No.
Who comes from?
Lot.
Right, remember where this all started? Remember when we took Lot along and we weren't sure why Avram took Lot along just to break away from him? This whole process starts with the relationship between Lot and his daughters. His daughters, whose intention was purely the Shem Shemayim. Lot, whose probably was not. Whether you assume he had awareness of what was going on or not. Either way, his kavanah was not the Shem Shemayim. But it starts with Lot and his daughters. That produces Moab. And Moab eventually produces Ruth. Who does Ruth marry? We did this last year. I forget, 6 months ago, this was last week. Who does Ruth marry? Boaz. Where does Boaz come from? Where does Peretz come from? Come from Yehuda finding his own in the middle of the road. Who happens to turn out that her kavanah was also in the best of places. Happens to be his daughter-in-law, who's striving with Kayim the Zera of her first two husbands and his two sons, and everything that she's doing is L'Shem Shemayim. Every root of Malchus Beit David comes from a place that's broken, comes from a place of tshuva, comes from a place where there needs to be something that's fixed, comes from a place that's dark, where the light needs to be created. All the way until David himself comes about, and where even David HaMelech himself comes to sin with Bathsheba, and only on the contrasting background of the tshuva of that chait is Shlomo HaMelech able to reduce Miyab Beit HaMikdash. Every stop in the road to Beit HaMikdash, every stop in the road to Malchut Beit David and then Shlomo HaMelech is all fraught with problems and tshuva. Ultimately, the Mashiach of the Baal Tshuva, Mashiach ben David, coming from the line of Yehuda, coming through David HaMelech, that is the ultimate line of Malchut in history. It's the Malchut of the Baal Tshuva that's going to get us to the end of days and build Beit HaMikdash. And that's an incredibly empowering concept. It doesn't mean that we can sin, but it means that if we do, lo aleinu, come to sin, that we have the ability to change, to turn back that clock, to transform that sin into potential energy of Avodas Hashem. If it's Tshuva Me'ava, we can turn it literally into a schus. It literally comes with us to Olam Haba. That moment of embarrassment for Olam Haba becomes a chelek of our Olam Haba. That's the reality of the Baal Tshuva. That's what's going to bring us to the ultimate reality of Mashiach. What we're going to do next time is make sure that we don't leave behind our friend, Yosef. Because obviously there are also tremendous milas to the tzaddik, and we'll hopefully balance things out a little bit next time. We'll conclude this aspect of the discussion. We'll talk about the ma'alot of the tzaddik, the unique ma'alot of the tzaddik, as relating to one of the key elements of Yosef, which comes up again and again and again throughout his story. What is one of his defining characteristics? Of Yosef. Shot of the story. What does he keep tripping over? Figuratively. He doesn't actually trip over them.
Dreams.
Dreams! Right? Yosef's the dreamer. So we'll talk about that next time. What is the essence of the tzaddik? What is the relationship between the tzaddik and dreams? What are dreams about? And really get into a little bit about what the essence of the tzaddik is, and the malot of the tzaddik as well. Since again, the road to Mashiach is paved by Mashiach ben Yosef to eventually lead forward Mashiach ben David. We should all be zoche to live lives of being tzaddikim at tzidkaniot. And in lieu of that, should we accidentally trip and fall, be able to harness those mistakes to be able to make us into the Baalei Tshuva that will bring about the Mashiach ben David, Bezrat Hashem, here.